Well, welcome everybody. Welcome if you're short of a seat, there's still a row at the front here. It's always embarrassing if you're late, isn't it, because you have to come right to the front. Let me introduce myself. My name is Bob White. I'm a geophysicist in the university and also associate director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion. And this lecture is put on by the Faraday Institute and Christians in Science. It's one of a termly lectures series, so the next one will be, I'm afraid, way back into November, but there's one a term, so we're very glad you could come. Let me just give the safety notice first. There are three ways out of the building. Two of them are the doors that you came in, and the third is on my right, your left. Don't try and go out this way, because it doesn't go anywhere, if there's a fire, but of course we hope there won't be. Let me tell you a little bit about Tom Wright. Why don't you come down and sit at the front? There's lots of seats along here. Tom Wright is a well-known broadcaster for TV and radio, but before that he's worked in both Oxford and Cambridge. He took degrees mostly in Oxford, though he finished one off in Cambridge, in classics and in theology, and he's had academic posts in Oxford, Cambridge and McGill in North America. Then he's had full-time appointments with the church as Dean of Lichfield from 94 for 5 years. He was then Canon Theologian of Westminster for 3 years before he went to Durham, where he is now Bishop of Durham since 2003. He's written many books, and there's quite a few of them on sale. You might want to go and look at them at the end of the lecture along with a glass of refreshment. There's a very thick one indeed on the resurrection of the Son of God, which I can recommend. But there's also some very thin ones and some in-between ones, which all have the same scholarship in them, accessible to a wide variety of moods that you may be in when you read them. So I can recommend that bookstall at the end. So do look at that. Today's lecture is titled, Can a Scientist Believe the Resurrection? And the reason we chose this title is because the resurrection is such a central part of the Christian faith. And now, of course, is the season that we're thinking of the resurrection of Christ after Easter and before Ascension. And as the Apostle Paul said, who was a very straightforward speaking man in those first decades after Christ died, he said, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, he said, our faith is futile. Absolutely futile, and of most people we are the most to be pitied. It's that important whether he rose from the dead or not. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Wright tonight to talk on that topic to us. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for your welcome and for actually the unexpected invitation to deliver this lecture. I say unexpected because I don't normally lecture on titles with the word science in them for a very good reason. I make no claim to know anything about science. I did precisely 1 year of physics and chemistry at school, and since I knew before I began that I was going to give them up to concentrate on classics, I confess that I did as little work as I could without actually entering a penal zone. In fact, my chemistry report in the summer of 1963 said he has maintained his position in the class, which was, of course, 24th out of 24. And then the master added, with occasional signs of interest now and then. I did, however, love mathematics with its elegance and its harmonies. And that was the subject I was most sorry to give up after O-level. But that's another story. I wrote that line in this lecture before I knew that, to my shock, the man who taught me maths when I was 13 was going to be in the room tonight. So there you are. So a question beginning, can a scientist, is a bit of a dangerous one for me to address. Of course, it's possible to give a short and trivial answer, like the man who, when asked whether he believed in infant baptism, said, sure, I've seen it done. That, of course, exposes one of the problems with the phrase believe in. Does it mean believe that it can be done or believe that it should be done? And there are other possibilities too, as we'll see. So similarly to the question, can a scientist believe in the resurrection? One might simply reply, sure, I've seen it done. I know plenty of scientists, including some in this city, who firmly and avowedly believe in the resurrection of Jesus, and some indeed who have given a solid and coherent account of why they do so. And I salute them, but I do not intend tonight to engage with the different ways in which they have presented their case. I want rather to explore something at the fault lines, if that's the right phrase, between different ways of knowing, between what we may loosely call scientific knowing and historical knowing, and between both of these and those other modes of knowing which we give very loosely the names faith and hope and love. And my case, you will not be surprised to learn, is that these ways of knowing do in fact overlap and interlock much more than we normally suppose. Certainly, much more than a certain kind of rhetoric would try to persuade us. It's been a feature of the last 200 years that we invoke a kind of pan-enlightenment thesis, namely, that the methods and results of modern science have delivered us from medieval superstition and ignorance. So that everything that went before, say, 1750, with a few golden exceptions, was ignorance and guesswork, and everything since then has been an upward path into the light. Now, I am sometimes accused of being anti-enlightenment, and because I give some weight to the postmodern critique, I suppose there is a measure of truth in that. But I want to assure you that I have no wish to return, say, to pre-enlightenment dentistry or sanitation or travel to look no further. I merely note that there are obvious ambiguities as well as obvious massive gains in the science and indeed the general culture of the last 200 or 300 years. The movement that gave us penicillin also gave us Hiroshima. And I know that's an oversimplification, but you see the point I'm making. And somehow, as most admit, and I suspect all know in their bones, science in the strict sense can never be enough. Enough, that is, for a full and flourishing human life in all its dimensions. But the question I've been given for tonight turns on this word believe, and here there are puzzles to explore. Plato, of course, declared that belief was a sort of second-rate kind of knowing, more or less halfway, in fact, between knowing and not knowing. So that the objects of belief possessed for Plato a kind of intermediate nature, that which is halfway between being and not being. And that way of thinking has coloured our popular usage in English to this day. So that if we say, I believe it's raining, we are cushioning ourselves against the possibility it might be wrong. Whereas when we say, I know it's raining, we are open to straightforward contradiction, much stronger statement. But this usage has slid over the last centuries to the point where, with a kind of implicit positivism, we use know and knowledge for things we think we really can in some sense prove. This is real knowledge. And believe, and its cognates, for things which sort of degenerate into mere private opinion without having necessarily much purchase on the wider world. That's simply a comment on how these words are used and how slippery they are. But the Christian claim was from the beginning, as we've already heard, that the question of Jesus' resurrection was a question not of the internal, mental, and spiritual states of his followers a few days after his crucifixion, but about something that had happened in the real public world, leaving not only an empty tomb, but a broken loaf on the table at Emmaus, and perhaps footprints in the sand by the lake among its physical mementos, and leaving Jesus' followers with a lot of explaining to do, but with a transformed worldview, which is only explicable on the assumption that something really did happen, even though it stretched their existing worldviews to breaking point. More of that anon. What we have to do now is to examine this early Christian claim a bit more thoroughly and to ask what can be said about it historically and to inquire more particularly what kind of knowing or believing we are talking about when we ask whether a scientist can believe that which it seems the resurrection actually refers to. So first, some further reflections, unsystematic musings, really, on types of knowing. I assume that when we ask, can a scientist believe something, we're doing at least two sorts of thing. First, we're asking about what sorts of things the scientific method can explore, and how it can know or believe certain things. And second, we're asking about the kind of commitment someone wedded to scientific exploration is expected to have in all her or his other areas of life. Is a scientist, for example, expected to have a scientific approach to listening to music, or to watching a football game, or to falling in love? The question assumes, I think, that the resurrection, and perhaps particularly the resurrection of Jesus, is something that might be expected to impinge upon a scientist's proper area of concern. Somewhat as if one were to say, can a scientist believe that the sun can rise twice in the same day? Or can a scientist believe that a moth could fly to the moon? In other words, it carries an implicit presumption that actually a scientist would have to say, no, I can't believe that for good reasons. I did once see the sun set twice in a day because it set just before I took off in a plane from Aberdeen Airport in the autumn flying south. And as we rose, the sun rose again in the west. Now, that's something to have seen the sun rise in the west and then it set again. But that was, of course, cheating. But I think asking can a scientist believe that the sun could rise twice in a day, or that can a moth fly to the moon or something, is different from saying can a scientist believe that Schubert's music is beautiful, or can a scientist believe that her husband loves her. And there are those, of course, who by redefining the resurrection to make it simply a spiritual experience in the inner hearts and minds of the disciples have pulled the question towards the latter pair and away from the former, the sun rising and the moth flying to the moon. But that is ruled out by what, as we shall see, all first century users of the language of resurrection meant by the word. Resurrection in the first century meant, to all the people who used words like anastasis and its cognates, people who were thoroughly physically dead becoming thoroughly physically alive again. Not that they had survived or entered a purely spiritual world, whatever that might be. And resurrection, therefore, impinges, the claim of resurrection impinges on the public world. But it is the public world, not first of the natural scientist in this case, but of the historian. To put it crudely, and again without all the necessary footnotes and nuances, science studies the repeatable while history studies the unrepeatable. Caesar only crossed the Rubicon once, and if he'd crossed it again, it would have meant something quite different the second time. There was and could only be one first landing on the moon. The fall of the second Jerusalem temple took place in AD 70 and never happened again. Historians, of course, don't see this as a problem, and they're usually not shy about declaring that these events certainly did take place, even though we can't repeat them in the laboratory, which is, of course, what scientists do. You repeat the experiment and you claim these are results which anyone doing the same thing would have got if they had done it in their laboratory, and so on. But when people say, as they do, such and such can't have happened because we know that that sort of thing doesn't actually happen, they are appealing to a kind of would-be scientific principle of history, namely the principle of analogy. The problem with analogy is that it never quite gets you far enough, because history is full of unlikely things that have happened once and once only, so that the analogies are at best often only partial and are in any case dependent on the retort who says to the objection about some kinds of things not normally happening. And indeed, in the case in point of the resurrection, we should note as an obvious but often overlooked point the fact that the early Christians did not think that Jesus' resurrection was simply one instance of the sort of thing that happened from time to time. Granted, they saw it as the first advance instance of something that would eventually happen to lots of other people, but they didn't employ that future hope or any sense that, oh, well, we live in a random universe, so all sorts of things are possible. No, they knew perfectly well dead people don't rise. That is actually part of early Christian belief, not an answer to it. So how does the historian work when the evidence points towards things which we don't normally expect to happen? The resurrection is such a prime example of this that it's actually hard to produce at this meta level analogies for that question. But sooner or later, questions of worldview loom up in the background. And the question of what kinds of material the historian will allow on stage is inevitably affected by the worldview within which he or she lives. And at that point, we're back to the question of the scientist who, faced with the thoroughly repeatable experiment of what always happens to dead bodies, what has always, it seems, happened, and what seems likely always to go on happening, declares, no, the evidence is so massive that it's impossible to believe in the resurrection without ceasing to be a scientist altogether. That's the point at which we must switch tracks and go to the evidence itself. What can be said within whatever might be called scientific historiography about the proposition that Jesus of Nazareth was bodily raised from the dead? I have sketched elsewhere the map of ancient beliefs about life beyond the grave. You've already had a plug for the big green book called The Resurrection of the Son of God. The bit of the lecture which follows now tracks with that book quite closely at certain points, summarizing maybe 100 pages in every two sentences. So hold on to your seats. Not quite, but nearly. When you look at the map of ancient beliefs about what happens beyond the grave, you discover that ancient paganism contains all kinds of theories, but whenever resurrection is mentioned, the answer is a firm negative. We know that doesn't happen. This is really worth stressing in tonight's context. I once did a television debate with Gerd Ludemann, who's a skeptical German New Testament scholar, who thumped the table at one point and said, we know that resurrection does not happen. I said, how do you mean we know? And he said, we have 200 years of scientific work to back up the fact that resurrection doesn't happen. I said, you don't have 200 years. You have however many years there have ever been. You know, Plato knew the dead don't get raised. Homer knew the dead don't get raised. Aeschylus makes it a major point in one of his plays. Pliny the Elder, when challenged about the odd idea that somebody's heard about resurrection, says, no, of course that doesn't happen. This is not something that it took 18th century scientists to figure out. So everyone in the ancient world knew that. Ancient Judaism, on the other hand, is rooted in the belief that God is the creator of the world, or to put it the other way around, that there is a creator of the world who will call God for the sake of argument, and that this God, who is the creator, will one day put the world to rights, will sort the whole mess out. And if you take creation and judgment in that sense, putting to rights together, and see what they do when they meet in the middle, you discover again and again, especially in times of persecution and martyrdom, people say, resurrection, new creation. Resurrection is the point at which creation and judgment meet in the middle. The early Christian belief in hope beyond death thus belongs demonstrably on the Jewish map, not the pagan map. But the foundation of my argument for what happened at Easter is the reflection that this Jewish hope has undergone remarkable modifications or mutations within early Christianity. You look at the history of early Christianity over the first two centuries, you see the Jewish hope for resurrection, but it's been changed. And since what you believe about what happens at and after death is a very conservative feature in most cultures, faced with death, most people go back to the security of the worldview they've already got. It really does pose the historical question, why did they change their beliefs like this? Can't have been because going out from Judaism, they were adopting bits and pieces of paganism, because paganism said it doesn't happen. Why did these mutations happen within Judaism, in the version of Judaism that the early Christians held? And let's be quite clear what we're talking about with resurrection. Resurrection is a belief in a two-step post-mortem future. Resurrection is not dying and going to heaven. I've said it often enough, I'll say it again. Heaven is important, but it's not the end of the world. The Christian belief, like the ancient Jewish belief, is that after death you go to be with God, Christian language, with Christ, whatever, but that then there is a second stage, which is God's new creation, within which we're promised resurrection. That's the basic shape of the belief, Judaism and Christianity. So there are seven mutations which I have tracked, and I'm giving them very briefly, and each one could be spelt out and annotated. The first mutation is that, unlike ancient Judaism, there is virtually no spectrum of belief in early Christianity. Judaism, you have the Pharisees, who represent the majority, who do believe in resurrection, but you have the Sadducees who don't, and you have people like Philo who believe in a one-step disembodied immortality. There is no such spectrum in early Christianity. One or two tiny mutant varieties here and there, but broadly, it's amazing just how much they're all on board with resurrection. Second mutation, in Second Temple Judaism, resurrection is important, but not that important. You can read masses of rabbinic tractates without ever a mention of resurrection. It's one topic among others, an interesting one, but not a driving, central, massive thing. It's still difficult to know what the Dead Sea Scrolls thought about resurrection. But in early Christianity, resurrection has moved from the circumference to the center. It's right in the... You can't imagine Paul's thought without it. You shouldn't imagine John's thought without it. If you take away the stories of Jesus' birth, you would lose a couple of chapters from Matthew and a couple of chapters from Luke. Not much else. But if you take away the stories of the resurrection, you won't have a New Testament at all. The third mutation has to do with what precisely resurrection means. Because in Judaism, it's normally left quite vague as to what sort of a body the resurrected will possess. In some of the martyr literature, like the Maccabees, they think of it basically as a body very much like this. You can kill me, you can torture me, the martyrs say, God will give me a body back just like this. Okay. But others talk about the body shining like a star, Daniel chapter 12 and elsewhere. But from the start, the early Christians didn't believe quite either of those things. They believed that the resurrection body, though it would certainly be a body in the sense of a physical object in our language, would be a transformed body. A body whose material, created from the old material, would have new properties. That's what Paul meant by the spiritual body. People often misunderstand that and think he means a non-physical body. The RSV and the NRSV have really left us in the mud at that point with bad mistranslations. No, the word sometimes translated spiritual there doesn't refer to the thing of which the body is made. It refers to the energy which is animating the body. Like the difference between a steamship and a sailship, as opposed to a wooden ship or a steel ship. And this is about the energy which animates. It's a body animated by the Spirit. And the point about this body is that whereas the present flesh and blood is corruptible, doomed to decay and die, the new body will be incorruptible. 1 Corinthians 15, one of Paul's longest discussions of anything, actually, is about the Creator God remaking the creation, not abandoning it, as Platonists of all sorts, including the Gnostics, would have wanted. The fourth surprising mutation is that the resurrection has split into two. For ancient Jews, the resurrection was what would happen to everyone at the end of time. For the early Christians, it's already happened in Jesus as a kind of advance down payment of what is to come at the end. Think of John 11, where Jesus says to the sisters grieving over Lazarus, your brother will rise again. They say, yeah, he'll rise again, the resurrection, on the last day. And Jesus says those extraordinary words, I am the resurrection. Resurrection has ceased to be a hope about the future and has become a person in the present. That splitting apart of resurrection is a total novum in Christianity. At this point, there's a whole riff we could get into where you can rule out the sort of things that scholars have often said. Ah, well, after Jesus' death, they had this innate sense that his project was still continuing, or that God's kingdom was still coming despite losing him, or that he was somehow with them strangely, or whatever. If you imagine a Jewish messianic revolutionary movement, and there were several in the first century, suffering the violent death of its founder or leader, imagine going to Rome in AD 70 after Titus had defeated the Jews and taken a whole host of captives back, and they brought Simon Bar Giora, the king of the Jews, at the back of the triumphal procession, and eventually they killed him. If you imagine some of Simon Bar Giora's followers had managed to escape somehow, in hiding, in shock, and then a few days later, one of them had said, you know, I think he's been raised from the dead. They said, what on earth do you mean? What are you talking about? Oh, well, I think somehow his project is continuing. Or, I actually had a sense last night that he was with me. I felt my heart being strangely warmed. They would round on him and say, what do you mean? You're talking rubbish. Okay, maybe the kingdom of God is still going to come, but not through him it isn't. And if your heart's strangely warmed, then for goodness sake, sing a psalm. Don't talk about him being raised from the dead. Being raised from the dead is a very, very specific claim. It isn't about those other things. Routinely, those other Jewish movements ended with the violent death of the central figure, and members of the movement, always supposing they got away with their own skins, then faced a choice. Either you give up the struggle, or you find yourself a new Messiah. Going around saying that the old one's somehow alive again, just, you know, they didn't have the leisure to suffer from that blessed 20th century disease called cognitive dissonance. They really didn't. What is more, to round off this final mutation, the messianic mutation within Jewish belief, because of the early Christian belief in Jesus as Messiah, we find the development of a very early belief that Jesus is Lord and that therefore Caesar isn't. That's a whole other topic for a whole other occasion. Death is the last weapon of the tyrant. And the point of the resurrection, despite much misunderstanding, is that death has been defeated and the tyrant's power is therefore broken, with all kinds of spin-offs. Now, all these mutations, they're on the map of first century Judaism, but no first century Jew who didn't become a Christian thought like this. It's opened up a whole new way of seeing history and hope and hermeneutics, and this demands a historical explanation. Why did the early Christians modify the Jewish resurrection language in these seven ways and do it with such consistency? When we ask them, they reply that they've done it because of what they believe happened to Jesus on the third day after he died, of course. They all say that, which forces us to ask, what are we going to have to say about the very strange stories which they tell about that first day? When we plunge into the stories of that first Easter day, the accounts we find in the closing chapters of the four canonical Gospels, the beginning of Acts, we find that notoriously the accounts don't fit snugly together. How many women went to the tomb? How many angels or men did they meet there? And so on and so on. Did the disciples meet Jesus in Jerusalem or in Galilee or both? At this point, I'm fond of invoking the splendid story, some of you will know the book, of what happened in October 1946 when Karl Popper gave a paper in Ludwig Wittgenstein's seminar in King's. It's written up in the splendid little book called Wittgenstein's Poker, which I commend to you if you don't know it. Several highly intelligent men, indeed they would probably modestly have said several of the most intelligent men in the world at the time, were in the room as Wittgenstein brandished a poker and then left abruptly before the seminar was over. Or did he? Because none of them could agree afterwards as to what precisely had happened. When you compare the accounts that all these, Bertrand Russell, all sorts of people, what they said happened, that the accounts didn't match up. But nobody doubted that something quite dramatic had happened involving Wittgenstein, Popper, and a poker taken from the fireplace. As with Cambridge in 1946, so with Jerusalem in AD 30 or whenever, surface discrepancies don't mean that nothing happened. Indeed, they are a reasonable indication that something very remarkable happened, which was so extraordinary that it quickly generated different ways of telling the story. Now, as part of the much larger argument I've advanced elsewhere, I want to draw attention just briefly to four very strange features shared by the accounts of Easter in all four canonical Gospels. You see, I'm coming from a background where, if you read the scholarly literature on the resurrection over the last 100 years, again and again and again we're told, well, these resurrection stories were written up many years later, maybe decades, maybe even half a century or more later, by people who certainly weren't there at the time and were just fantasizing about what it might have been like, and spinning these stories out of their own spirituality, out of their own hope, out of their reading of scripture, and so on. Actually, when you look at them, it's odd. First, note the strange silence of the Bible, the Old Testament, in the stories. Up to that point, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have all drawn heavily upon biblical quotation and allusion and echo. But the resurrection narratives are almost entirely innocent of them. And that's the more remarkable, in that from as early as Paul, the common creedal formula declared that the resurrection was according to the scriptures. And Paul and the others ransack the Psalms and the prophets to find texts to explain what's happened and to set it within and as the climax to the long story of God and Israel. Why don't the gospel resurrection narratives do the same? Very odd. We could say, of course, that whoever wrote the stories in the form we now have them had gone through cunningly and taken material out to make them look as if they were old, like somebody deliberately taking out all the electric fittings from a house to make it look more antique than it actually is. Now, that might be marginally plausible if we just had one account, or possibly two, or if the four accounts were obviously derived from one another, but they aren't. You either have to imagine four very different writers, each deciding to write up an Easter narrative based on the theology of the early church, but with the biblical echoes taken out. Or you have to say, which is infinitely more probable, that the stories, even though written down a lot later, and, of course, embodying, in a measure, the theology of the different writers, much like different portraits of the same person may embody the different portraiture styles of the different artists, while it's still recognisably the same person, but that they go back to extremely early oral tradition, which had been formed and set firmly in the memory of different storytellers before there was any time for biblical reflection and exegesis to creep in. That's the first strange feature of the gospel stories. The second strange feature, whether we like it or not, is the presence of the women as the principal witnesses. Women were not, I'm afraid, regarded as credible witnesses within the ancient world. Nobody would have made them up. Had the tradition started in the male-only form that we find in 1 Corinthians 15, it would never have developed in such different ways as well into the female-first stories we find in the Gospels. It is truly striking. It would be striking today. It's enormously striking in the first century. The Gospels must embody the earliest storytelling, and 1 Corinthians 15 must embody a later revision. The third strange feature is the portrait of Jesus himself. If, as many revisionists have tried to make out, the gospel stories developed either from people mulling over the scriptures following Jesus' death or a new experience of inner illumination, you would expect to find the risen Jesus shining like a star. That's what the book of Daniel says will happen, and that was a very popular book at the time. And you got a story like that in the Transfiguration. But none of the Gospels say that about Jesus at Easter. Very odd. Indeed, he appears as a human being with a body that is in some ways quite normal and can be mistaken for a gardener or a fellow traveller on the road. Yet the stories also contain mysterious but definite signs that this body has been transformed. It's clearly physical. It's used up, so to speak, the material of the crucified body, hence the empty tomb. But it, embarrassingly, comes and goes through locked doors. It is not always recognised. And in the end, it disappears into God's space, heaven, through the thin curtain which in much Jewish thought separates God's space from human space. Now, this kind of account is without precedent, biblical or otherwise, and it looks as if the writers knew it. Ed Sanders, one of the greatest New Testament scholars of this last generation, and fairly sceptical in quite a lot of ways, says it looks as though they were trying to tell a story for which they didn't have the proper language. But they had to tell this story. And this rules out the old idea, by the way, that Luke's and John's account, which are the fullest and which are the most apparently physical, has Jesus eating and so on, were written late in the first century in an attempt to combat docetism, the idea that Jesus wasn't really a human but only seemed to be, we'll make him eat some bread or boiled fish or something and that'll be all right. Well, no. If they were combating docetism, they would never have said that the risen Jesus appeared and disappeared through locked doors, sometimes being recognised, sometimes not, finally ascended into heaven. That extraordinary passage in John's Gospel where some of the people who've been closest to Jesus, who've known him most intimately for some years, come up and meet him, and John says none of them dared ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Sort of sense of something very, very puzzling and mysterious going on there. Transformation. Quite unprecedented. The fourth strange feature of the resurrection accounts is the entire absence of mention of the future Christian hope. Almost everywhere else in the New Testament, when you get the resurrection of Jesus, it's spoken of in connection with the final hope that those who belong to Jesus will one day be raised as he has been, and with the note that this must be anticipated in the present in baptism and Christian behaviour. Insofar as the event is interpreted in the resurrection stories themselves, what does this mean? It doesn't mean, as in so many Easter sermons, Jesus has been raised, therefore we're going to heaven when we die. No, it's not the point. Jesus is raised, they say, therefore God's new creation has begun, and he is the Messiah and the world's true Lord, and we've got a job to do. That's the logic of the resurrection stories. Had they been invented towards the end of the first century, that interpretation would certainly have included the resurrection of all God's people. So from these four things, and again they could be developed, I conclude that the stories, though they've been lightly edited and written down later, are basically very, very early. They are not legends written later to give a pseudo-historical basis for an essentially private experience. And when we ask how could such stories have come into existence, the obvious answer is, well, though it was hard to describe at the time and remains mind-boggling thereafter, something like this is what happened. So it's now time to ask at last, what can the historian say about this? And perhaps even what can the scientist say about it? The only way we can explain the phenomena that we've been examining is by proposing a two-pronged hypothesis. First, Jesus' tomb really was empty. Second, the disciples really did encounter him in ways which convinced them that he was not simply a ghost or an hallucination. Say a brief word about each. For the disciples to see, or thought they'd seen, somebody they took to be Jesus would not by itself have generated the stories we now have. It's quite touching, actually, how people today often say, oh, well, you know, it was obviously a ghost or hallucination. We know that, but they wouldn't have realized it, poor things, because they were primitive. Read the ancient literature. It's full of ghosts and visions and hallucinations. They do far more about such things than we do, and about the circumstances in which they happen, including the circumstance that sometimes when somebody you've been close to dies, you can experience them in the room with you. They can, as it were, visit you and smile and say something and then disappear. That's a very common, a comparatively very common phenomenon. And they knew about that sort of thing. Plenty of evidence for it in the first century. So if they'd seen someone they took to be Jesus shortly after his death, they would have said, well, it's one of those visions, one of those, it's a ghost, whatever. And in particular, we need to notice Jesus' burial was a standard primary burial. Wasn't like a grave in our world, put someone in a coffin in the ground. What you did was you laid out the corpse wrapped in grave clothes because you needed to put spices in there, because you'd be coming into this cave several more times with other corpses, or somebody would, and you didn't want to be overpowered by the smell. So you would lay the corpse out, and then you would wait, depending on how hot it was, between 6 months and 18 months, until the flesh had all rotted, and then you would do the secondary burial. You gather up the bones, you fold them up reverently with the skull on the top, and you put them in a bone box called an ossuary. Somebody would have had to do that sooner or later. Nobody in the Jewish world, however many hallucinations, visions, ghosts, etc. they'd had, would have spoken of somebody whose bones they were collecting up and storing having been raised from the dead. Obvious they hadn't been. Without the empty tomb, in other words, they would have been as quick to say hallucination as we would. Equally, an empty tomb by itself proves absolutely nothing. Grave robbery was common in the ancient world, especially of interesting and important people. Might just have been the wrong tomb. The soldiers, the gardeners, the chief priests, other disciples, someone else must have taken away the body. That was the conclusion that Mary drew in John's Gospel. And that was the story the Jewish leaders put about in Matthew's Gospel. Unless the finding of an empty tomb had been accompanied by sightings of and meetings with the risen Jesus, that's the conclusion they'd have drawn. This is a very nasty story, but we just assume somebody's taken the body. So you've got to have the meetings on the one hand and the empty tomb on the other. More or less, you can say the story about the grave clothes would have done instead of the empty tomb. There are other wrinkles like that, perhaps. But you've got to have both those phenomena to account for the rise of the belief and the telling of the stories the way that I've shown them. Neither by itself would be sufficient to generate that belief. Put them together, and they provide a complete and coherent explanation. Which then, of course, brings us face to face with the ultimate question. If the empty tomb and the meetings with Jesus are, in combination, the only possible explanation for the stories and beliefs that grew up so quickly, how do we explain them? Now, in any other historical inquiry, the answer would be so obvious that it would hardly need saying. The best explanation is that that's what happened. But here, of course, it is so shocking, so earth-shattering, that we rightly pause before leaping into the unknown. And here, indeed, as some sceptical friends have cheerfully pointed out to me, including my former philosophy tutor in Oxford, who read the book and sent me a long letter about it, but he said, more or less, I followed your argument. You're absolutely right. That must be how it was so far. He said, I simply don't have a good explanation for what happened to cause the empty tomb and the appearances. But I choose to maintain my belief that dead people don't rise, ever. And therefore I conclude that something else must have happened, even though I can't tell what it was. Now, that's fine. I respect that position. But I note that it is then a matter of worldview choice, not a matter of saying that something called scientific historiography has forced us to deny the resurrection. And at this moment in the argument, all the signposts are in fact pointing in one direction. I have examined elsewhere lots of the other alternative explanations, ancient and modern, that have been given for the rise of the early church, and there have been many. I have to say that far and away, the neatest, most elegant historical explanation is that Jesus of Nazareth, having been thoroughly dead and buried, really was raised to life on the third day with a new kind of physical body, which left an empty tomb behind it because it had used up the material of Jesus' original body, and which seemed to possess new properties that nobody had expected or imagined, but which quickly generated those new significant mutations in the thinking of those who encountered it. In other words, if something like this happened, it would perfectly explain why Christianity began and why it took the shape it did. Now, this is where I want to heed rather carefully the warnings of those theologians who have cautioned against any attempt to stand on the ground of post-Enlightenment rationalism and to attempt to prove in some mathematical fashion something which, if it happened, ought to be regarded as the centre not only of history but also of epistemology, not only of what we know but also of how we know it. In other words, if you say, right, we're going to be rationalist about this, we'll stand on this ground and I will now prove that the resurrection happened, then ultimately post-Enlightenment rationalism has won rather than the resurrection. The resurrection becomes a function of that, and that's not the role it plays in the New Testament. And this is where the third element in knowing, again, I'm collapsing several major philosophical discussions into one rather simplistic account here. The third element in knowing, the puzzling bits beyond science or history but still interacting with both, inevitably come into play. I once, preaching a sermon on this, imagined in a sort of fantasy Oxbridge scenario, a rich old member giving to a college a wonderful, glorious painting which simply wouldn't fit into any of the spaces available in the college, neither the chapel nor the hall nor the wherever, and which was so magnificent that eventually the college decides to pull itself down and to rebuild itself around this great and unexpected gift, and discovering as it does so that all the best things about the college the way it was are thereby enhanced within the new structure, and all the problems of which people have been aware with the college the way it was were thereby dealt with. And the key thing about that illustration, inadequate though it is, like all illustrations, is that there must be some point at which the painting is received by the existing college, some epistemological overlap point to enable the college officers to make their momentous decision. Some of you are probably on college governing bodies. I hope you can just imagine them wrangling with them. You know, the donor doesn't just come along and blow up the college, present the painting, and then say, now figure out what to do. No. My point is that the resurrection of Jesus, presenting itself as it does to the as the obvious answer to the question that anyone from any worldview point might ask about how Christianity got going and why it took the shape it did, the resurrection of Jesus has that kind of purchase on serious historical inquiry, and therefore poses that kind of challenge to the larger worldview of both the historian and the scientist. And the challenge is, in fact, the challenge of new creation. To put it at its most basic, the resurrection of Jesus offers itself to the student of history or science, no less than the Christian or the theologian, not as a very odd event within the world as it is, though to be sure it is that, but as the utterly characteristic, prototypical, and foundational event within the world as it has begun to be. It isn't an absurd event within the old world. It is the symbol and starting point of the new world. And the claim advanced in Christianity is of that magnitude, that with Jesus of Nazareth, there is not simply a new religious possibility, for goodness sake, plenty of those already, not simply a new ethic, not even simply a new or clearer or more sharply focused way of salvation, but a new creation. Now that might seem to be an epistemological as well as a theological preemptive strike. If there is really a new creation on the loose, well, the historian wouldn't have any analogies for it, the scientist wouldn't be able to rank its characteristic events with other events that might otherwise have been open to inspection, so what are we to do? No other explanations have been offered in 2,000 years of sneering skepticism against the Christian witness that can satisfactorily account for how the tomb came to be empty, how the disciples came to see Jesus, and how their lives and worldviews were transformed. But history alone, certainly as conceived within the modern Western world and placed on the Procrustean bed of the science which rightly observes the world as it is what science has got to do, appears to leave us rather like in the story of the Exodus, the children of Israel shivering on the seashore with Pharaoh, the skeptics, coming up fast behind them, and the deep sea of unknown possibilities ahead of them. What are they going to do? These questions can, in other words, press the question to which Christian faith is the obvious answer. But if somebody chooses to stay between the Pharaoh and the deep sea, history itself cannot force them further, I don't think. Everything then depends on the context within which the history is done. The most important decisions we make in life, I think, are not taken by post-Enlightenment left-brain rationality alone. I would not suggest, in other words, some reviewers have criticized me for suggesting, and I don't think I intended to, and I hope I didn't, I would not suggest that one can argue right up to the central truth of Christian faith by pure human reason, building on simple observation of historical data in the world. Indeed, I think it's obvious you can't. Indeed, equally, I would not suggest that historical investigation of this sort has therefore no part to play, so that all that is required is a blind leap of faith. That's why I say there is, in fact, an epistemological overlap. Historians and theologians find that very uncomfortable, but I think it's true. God has given us minds to think. The question has been appropriately raised, did it or didn't it happen? Christianity appeals to history, and to history it must go. And the question of Jesus' resurrection, though in some ways it bursts the boundaries of history, also simultaneously remains within them. If there was an empty tomb, that's a historical datum. That's precisely why it's so important, so disturbing, so life and death. We could cope, the world could cope, with a Jesus who ultimately remains a wonderful idea within his disciples' minds and hearts. The world cannot cope without an explosion, a pulling down and a rebuilding, with a Jesus who comes out of the tomb, who inaugurates God's new creation right within the middle of and affecting the old one. And that's why, for a complete approach to the question, we need to locate our study of history within a larger complex of human, personal, and corporate contexts. And this, of course, forms a challenge not only to the historian, not only to the scientist, but to all humans in whatever worldview they habitually live. The story of Thomas in John chapter 20 serves as a parable for this. Thomas, like a good historian, wants to touch and see. He wants evidence. Good scientist. Jesus presents him to his sight and invites him to touch. But Thomas doesn't, or we're not told he does. He transcends the type of knowing he had intended to use and passes into a higher and richer one. Instead of, I want to touch and see, he says, my Lord and my God, bringing history and faith together in a rush. And that isn't an anti-historical statement. Forget history. I just know this is my Lord. No, the Lord in question is precisely the one who is the climax of Israel's history and the launch of a new history. And once you grasp the resurrection, you see that Israel's history is full of partial and preparatory semi-analogies for this moment, so that the epistemological weight is borne not simply, as Pannenberg said, by the ultimate resurrection of all people at the end, but by the narrative of God's mighty acts in the past. Nor is Thomas's an anti-scientific statement, since the world of new creation is precisely the world of new creation, and as such is open to, and indeed eager for, the work of humans, not to manipulate it with magic tricks, nor to be subservient to it as though the world of creation were itself divine, but to be its stewards. And stewards need to pay close, minute attention to that of which they are stewards, in order the better to serve it and to enable it to attain its intended fruitfulness. What I'm suggesting then is that Thomas-like faith in the risen Jesus transcends but includes what we call history and what we call science. Faith of this sort isn't blind belief which rejects history and science, nor is it simply, which would be much safer, a belief which simply inhabits a totally different sphere. Oh, you can do your history and science down there, and from time to time you escape into this other area called faith, and then you go back and to and fro. No. This kind of faith, which is in fact like all modes of knowledge, defined by the nature of its object, is faith in the Creator God, the God who's promised to put all things to rights at last, and the God who, as the sharp point between those, has raised Jesus from the dead within history, leaving, as I said, evidence which demands an explanation from the scientist like everybody else. Insofar as I understand scientific method, granted the caveats at the beginning, when something turns up which doesn't fit the paradigm you're working with, one option at least, perhaps when all others have failed, you've got to try them all out, is to change the paradigm. Not to exclude everything you've known to that point, but to include it within a larger whole. That is, if you like, the Thomas challenge, faith. If Thomas represents an epistemology of faith, which transcends but also includes historical and scientific knowing, we might suggest that Paul represents at this point an epistemology of hope. In 1 Corinthians 15, he sketches his big argument for a future resurrection. And in Romans 8, he talks about the new creation which God is going to make, born out of the womb of the suffering old creation. And because he can glimpse that big picture rooted in God the Creator, and God the one who will put it all to rights at the last, he has a mode of knowing which enables him to know about Jesus with a knowledge which is both faith and hope. Much more to be said about that, but not here. I want rather to finish with Peter. Epistemologies of faith and hope, both transcending but including historical and scientific knowing, point on to an epistemology of love, an idea I first met in Bernard Lonergan, but which was hardly new with him. The story of John chapter 21 sharpens it up. Peter famously has denied Jesus three times. The story is well known. Peter has chosen to live within creation as it is, the world where tyrants win in the end, and where it's better to dissociate yourself quickly from people who get on the wrong side of them. That is business as usual. But now with Easter, Peter is called to live in a new and different world, where Thomas is called to a new kind of faith and Paul to a radically renewed hope. Peter is called to a new kind of love. Here I go back to Wittgenstein once more, not this time for a poker, but for that famous and haunting aphorism. It is love that believes the resurrection. Simon, son of John, says Jesus, do you love me? There's a whole world in that question. A world of personal invitation and challenge. A world of the remaking of a human being after disloyalty and disaster. Of the refashioning of epistemology itself. The question of how we know things to correspond to the new ontology. The question of what God's new world is like. Love is the epistemology which makes sense of the new creation. The reality which is the resurrection cannot simply be known from within the old world of decay and denial, of tyrants and torture, of disobedience and death. But that's the point. As I said, the resurrection is not, as it were, a highly peculiar event within the present world, though it is that as well. It is the defining, central, prototypical event of the new creation. The world which is being born with Jesus. And if we're even to glimpse this new world, let alone enter it, we will need that different way of knowing. A knowing which involves us in new ways. An epistemology which draws out from us not just the cool appraisal of detached quasi-scientific research, but the whole person engagement and involvement for which the best shorthand is love, in the full Johannine sense of agape. My sense from talking to some scientific colleagues is that, though it's hard to describe, something like this is already at work when the scientist devotes himself or herself to the subject matter so much that the birth of new hypotheses seems to be not so much of an abstract brain, a computer made of meat, crunching data from elsewhere, but more of a soft symbiosis of knower and known, of lover and beloved. Now, the skeptic will quickly suggest that what I've said is, after all, a way of collapsing the truth of Easter once more into mere subjectivism. What is this love business? Not so. Just because it takes agape to believe the resurrection, that doesn't mean that all that happened was that Peter and his friends felt their hearts strangely warmed. Precisely because it is love we're talking about, not lust, it must have a correlative reality in the world outside the lover. Love is the deepest mode of knowing, because it is love that, while completely engaging with reality which is profoundly other than itself, affirms and celebrates that other than self reality with joy and gladness. In other words, it is both objective and subjective, if you like. That is the mode of knowing which is necessary if we are to live in the new creation, the new public world, the world launched at Easter, the world in which Jesus is Lord and Caesar isn't. And that is why, although the historical arguments for Jesus' bodily resurrection are truly strong, we must never suppose that they will do more than bring people to the questions faced by Thomas and Peter, the questions of faith and love. We cannot use a supposedly objective historical epistemology as the ultimate ground for the truth of Easter. To do so would be like somebody who lit a candle to see whether the sun had risen. What the candles of historical scholarship will do is to show that the room has been disturbed, that it doesn't look like it did last night, and that would-be normal explanations for this won't do. Maybe, we think, after the historical arguments have done their work, maybe morning has come and the world has woken up. But to find out whether this is so, we must take the risk and open the curtains to the rising sun. And when we do so, we may not rely on the candles anymore, not because we don't believe in evidence and argument, not because we don't believe in history and science, but because they will have been overtaken by the larger reality from which they borrow, to which they point, and in which they will find a new and larger home. All knowing is a gift from God, historical and scientific knowing no less than that of faith and hope and love. But the greatest of these is love. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. I think you've agreed to answer questions. It's great. We have two roving microphones. So if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please put your hand up and a microphone will be brought to you. Don't say anything till it arrives or we won't hear. Anybody? There's one in the middle.
I've very much enjoyed the point that you've been making about the new creation and our perception of that as being central to the whole meaning of Christianity. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on the view that did the church throughout the Middle Ages increasingly lose the plot in focusing increasingly on the death of Christ and the meaning of the death rather than seeing our living the new creation as the purpose of what we're about as Christians?
Point one, I'm not a medievalist any more than I'm a scientist, so I have to be terribly careful about anything between 500 AD and 1500 AD. I'm afraid that's just the syllabus that I did, and I've never remedied that, so it's a shame. Really. Point two, I do think the medieval period, as far as I can make out, did distort various things, not least eschatology. I wouldn't have said this was because of an exploration of the meaning of the death of Jesus, because the New Testament is full of that as well. And indeed, though I've scarcely mentioned it, you can tell the story one way, highlighting the death of Jesus. You can tell the story another way, highlighting the resurrection of Jesus. as I've done in obedience to my commission tonight, but actually for completion. You really do need both to do justice to the New Testament. Now, I think the problem came rather that because of the fixation in the Middle Ages on the ultimate vision of God and seen in terms of going to heaven rather than new creation and resurrection, the question then was, what's holding you back from going to heaven? Well, it's sin and all that. Therefore, how are you going to get rid of sin? Well, there's the death of Jesus, but then you're still pretty sinful once you believed in that, so you need purgatory and all the rest of it. So an enormous mythology grows up about post-mortem destinations and all the rest of it, which is very much about suffering, very much about pain, very much about shame and guilt and all that, and which then does, I think quite rightly, that's where you're starting, the cross is where you've got to go to make some sense of it. But what you don't find then is nearly so much about the resurrection. I think Dante, one of the most wonderful Christian poems ever written, has got a lot to answer for, actually, by setting up, you know, heaven, hell and purgatory. And in a sense, even, you know, people like Bunyan much later, without much sense of new creation and of what that two-step post-mortem destination, destiny it might be, then all sorts of other things come in. So I do think there were distortions in the Middle Ages. I wouldn't say it was because of a concentration on the cross, because concentration on the cross ought to be a good thing, something that Paul and John and people do, rather. But because of other things they were doing, I think they distorted what they did with the cross. Very broad brush, I'm afraid. So, question right up the back, or...
Thank you. Jesus said to Mary, "Don't touch me," and yet he said to Thomas, "Touch me." Why do you think this is?
I don't know whether to be cross that you put your finger on yet another or one of the obvious problems, or glad that you drew out from me something which didn't have space in the lecture. The scene with Mary, which of course is made famous in art and all the rest of it, I think you can only understand that if you take the next line as well, which is this very odd one, "For I have not yet ascended to the Father." I think it's something to do with the transformed physical reality. And I think within the echoes which John is setting up at that point, it's something to do with warning Mary against imagining an oversimplified Maccabean-style resurrection, that we're just back to normal then. In other words, the journey through death and into resurrection is not going somewhere and coming back again. It's going somewhere and then on out the other side into a new world, which is going to involve ascension. People often forget that the ascension is a Johannine doctrine and not only a Lucan one. I say that conscious that some of you may be preaching sermons in a couple of days' time. The ascension in John seems to me clearly distinguished from the resurrection, despite what people sometimes say. And it does have to do with the conjoining of the heavenly reality and the earthly reality in ways for which there was no precedent, and in ways for which Mary's natural longing, as it were, to have Jesus back again, would have been a denial. So that the reason why, I think this is how we have to construe John, the reason why Mary wanted to touch Jesus was a very different reason from the reason why Thomas wanted to touch Jesus. Thomas wasn't trying to keep him, he just wanted to be sure it really was him. That's probably the best we can do at the moment, though I agree that, like a lot of other things in John 20 and 21, it is deeply, deeply mysterious. But I see that mysteriousness pointing precisely to the oddity of the story they were telling, which then reinforces my point that if they were making it up 40 or 50 years ago, later, they certainly wouldn't have done it like that, leaving all those loose ends lying around. Hand right at the very back. Up the top. Don't be shy. If this were an American audience, we'd have had 50 questions by now. Yeah.
Thanks. There's an interesting question lurking underneath the one that you were asked to address, which is the resurrection scientifically intelligible? And I was wondering through much of your lecture what your answer was to that. And for much of the time, I thought the answer was no. And then about 5 or 10 minutes before the end, I thought you were saying, this is such an extraordinary event, the resurrection, that science has to make some sense of it. Mm. And if that involves a change in its assumptions, its methodology, so be it. It's something that science has to come to terms with. Mm. But then in the last sentence or two, I thought you were hinting that any way of understanding the resurrection would be so unlike the science we have at the moment that it wouldn't be recognizable as science. So I wasn't in the end quite sure what the implicit answer was to the question, is the resurrection scientifically intelligible?
Well, I would have to press you ultimately on what the phrase scientifically intelligible means. If you mean, could we repeat it in the laboratory at will so that we could study it and nail it down, the answer is absolutely not. But if you said, well, in the nature of the case, if there were such a thing, it wouldn't be that sort of repeatability we would be looking for. What we'd be looking for would be other signs of new creation. And part of our difficulty there is that, to be blunt, the last 200 years in the Western Church, we have been so browbeaten by the rhetoric of the Enlightenment that tells us that church history is part of the problem rather than part of the solution, that we sell ourselves short in the church and we fail to point out the many, many, many signs of new creation which have come about through the witness and the work of those who have followed Jesus. Not exclusively, you know, other people have built schools and hospitals, etc., etc. But if you read a book like, say, Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, it is extraordinary, the story that he tells of the first few centuries as to why Christianity spread, because of the way people were living, which was totally different from how anyone had thought of living before, and ways of extraordinary generosity and self-sacrifice which were hugely attractive and whose only explanation was something to do with that story of Jesus. And they would have said that this is the kind of repeating the experiment which is appropriate for that sort of new creation, you see? So that from that point of view, yes, it's a revaluing of what scientifically intelligible would mean. But it's a way of saying, if you want to see new creation, did it just happen once and then never again? Oh, no. No, it happens in all sorts of ways. And ultimately, the church's glorifying, if that's the right word, of saints was an attempt to say, at its best, new creation does go on happening. And if you live in a world where things are happening in the context of prayer, worship, witness, work on the street, whatever, then people who live within that world find the resurrection of Jesus more believable. Now, of course, people who don't live in that world say, well, you know, so you crank yourself up and so the fantasy works and so you manage to believe the impossible. But that's precisely where the question rubs, and that's where you need the more holistic account, not just an 18th century rationalist, rather Procrustean account of a more holistic view of what it means to be human, really. All sorts of other things could come out of that, but a question there and then one in the middle. Yeah.
You referred to a professor who chose not to want to believe in the resurrection, and you may be aware there's quite a debate going on in the Times over the last week with Richard Dawkins and then William Rees-Mogg about whether there's such a thing as a fundamental atheist, and people who... Mm-hmm. really choose not to want to believe in God at all. And Richard Dawkins is known for his book, The God Delusion. I wonder whether you could say something to... I imagine there could be quite a lot of people who might even follow his sort of thinking here, as to what you would want to really say to Richard Dawkins or to people who would follow his kind of line of thinking that just refusing to believe.
Yes. I didn't finish The God Delusion, I confess. I found that it was the sort of book that once I'd put it down, it was very difficult to pick it up again. But I did read about 200 pages of it, and where I got cross was about 1.5 pages on Jesus, where he quotes Geza Vermesh and he quotes somebody else, I can't remember who, Bart Ehrman, that's right, and says, well, there we are, because of what Vermesh has said, because of what Ehrman has said, we can ditch Jesus then, can't we? And I thought, well, I'm sorry, you know, pick your scholars to suit your case. You might actually do business with one or two others. You know, I could have listed some Jewish scholars, some some agnostic scholars, not just Christian ones, who've written very strong and powerful books about Jesus and say, you know, you have to do business with this man. And ultimately, the Christian answer is not to step back from Jesus and try and construct a complete case about God and the world and then fit Jesus into it at the last minute. The risk that Christianity takes, according to John 1 and Colossians 1 anyway, is to put Jesus in the middle of the picture and think about God and the world around that. And so a book which tries to, or appears to be going at these wretched Christians, but gives Jesus a couple of pages and wipes him off the map with reference to two themselves atheist scholars, simply won't do. That's just not good argument. So I would want to start there and see what happened if you worked out. But as I say, I didn't conclude. I mean, there only seems to be one real argument in Dawkins' book, which is, you know, that if there were a God, God would have to be much bigger and more extraordinary than everything else, but bigger and more extraordinary things develop out of lesser things. Therefore, God would be the end of the process, not the beginning. I take it, as I say, I'm not a scientist, but that seems to me to be the basic argument that he runs, and an awful lot of the rest is just wonderful rhetoric. So I would want to go back and say, sorry, we do have to talk about Jesus. Because the historical evidence is massive. When I was working on a thing with the BBC several years ago, Jeremy Bowen was in Jerusalem with us making a program about Jesus, and Jeremy confessed that until he was making that program, he thought that the phrase believing in Jesus meant believing that Jesus really existed. It was only making that program made him realize that everyone except a few very, very maverick people believe that Jesus existed. And the question is a very different one from that. But that's the level of ignorance in our world at the moment, about just the fact of who Jesus was, never mind any details. So I really would like to go back and start there. One in the middle there.
This is just a follow-on from what you've just been saying. What sort of ramifications would what you've been saying and the way the question's been going as well have for Christian apologetics now we're living in the 21st century?
Well, apologetics is a funny old thing. I am suspicious of the ultra-rationalist apologetic, which, and as you will have heard me say, which sometimes really does look as though it's saying, okay, we will have a rational foundation and simply pull in all the evidence and argue our way up, and at the end we've got the resurrection and the Trinity and the this and the that and QED. I'm just not sure that's how it goes. It seems to me there's a much more roundabout and circular process that has to happen of a challenge to worldviews, because actually the kind of secular rationality that kind of apologetic often assumes is, I think, part of the problem in the Western world and not a fixed point that we can argue from. That's not to say I don't believe in reason. I do believe in reason. I'm just not sure that the rationalism of the 18th and subsequent centuries really gets to the heart of what that lovely God-given thing called reason is really all about. And that's why I want to pull in faith, hope, and love, not as a step away from history and science, but as a more fully human way of embracing modes of inquiry, and as a recognition that, you know, if you can prove something, A plus B plus C equals D, therefore there's no choice, is there, then, as one reviewer did say, reviewing my big book, where's the room for faith in that? Now, I don't quite like that argument, because that implies sort of God of the gaps. You know, your argument will take you so far, and then you suddenly have to take this blind leap. I don't think it's like that either. I think it's that good historical work can scare off some of the possibilities for hiding. I'll start that sentence again. Bad historical arguments about the resurrection often hide in the bushes of faulty argumentation and hypotheses. Good historical work can scare them out from behind those bushes and say, sorry, you're faced with a choice. Do you want to live in a world like this, or do you want to live in a world like that? Here's something which happened, which is pushing you towards saying you might consider that. But at that point, you really do have to come round the back. So if you're considering that, it's not just one thing that you can have and then put on the mantelpiece as a kind of a trophy. Oh, I see, right. Now we have this thing called the resurrection. That's okay. No, if you're going to take that, it's like the college in the picture. You've got to tear down the walls and build something bigger.
Well, I'm conscious that some people have to get away. Shall we take one last question, and then...
There's one in the middle here.
One just here in the middle, and then we'll thank Tom very much.
You mentioned the resurrection as being a physical body with spiritual energy. And I'm wondering if you could say something about to what extent do you think the resurrection of Jesus is similar or different to the resurrection that God's people will have?
Oh, yes. Paul, obviously, in 1 Corinthians 15, sees the resurrection of Jesus as the prototype for the resurrection of all God's people, with this exception that Jesus was raised without being corrupted, without his body decaying. It's interesting in the early chapters of Acts how emphatic that is, because they're using Psalm 16 as an apologia and saying, David said, you will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. But David died and was buried, but here's someone who died but was buried and didn't corrupt, and he is the Messiah, and God has raised him from the dead without seeing corruption. And Paul is quite clear that apart from those who are alive when at the moment when God finally does renew all things, all others will corrupt and decay, and therefore the destination is the same, but the process is different. Does that make sense? But let's be quite clear, when we use, see, the word physical carries so many odd connotations for people, and many people in our world, understandably, find it difficult to think of something being physical but incorruptible. And what Paul is talking about, you know, people sometimes play off immortality against resurrection. That's dangerous, because Paul is talking about immortality. It's just an embodied immortality. It's a non-corruptible physicality. And that's why I talk in the book about a transformed physicality. I coin the word transphysicality. I looked it up in the OED and it wasn't there, so if it is in 100 years' time, blame me. And because there has to be a way of talking about this tertium quid. There's something which we don't know what it is, but which we have to say it is more than what we are, not less. I was talking to somebody at lunchtime today who reminded me that I had said many years ago in a sermon which she had heard that, you know, when you talk about somebody who's been ill, say, poor old so-and-so, he's just a shadow of his former self. If you are in Christ, you are just a shadow of your future self. There's something more real. And that is what you're seeing in those resurrection narratives, which is why they're so mysterious. Who is this? It is Jesus, but, you know, do we recognize it? It is Jesus, but he's non-corruptible. And that's the thing that we're promised.
Well, before we thank Bishop Tom again, let me remind you there are refreshments at the back. There's a great bookstore there. And we'll be around, and Bishop Tom will be around just for informal talks for the next three-quarters of an hour or so. So please do take advantage of that. If you want to know what the next lectures are, please do look at the Faraday Institute. Just Google Faraday Institute, and you can get put on an email newsletter list if you would like to. So let's thank Bishop Tom yet again. Thank you.